Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
You're listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am your host, Ray Barker, an archivist in Special Collections Department at MLK Library. Today, 14th episode of the podcast, from our Notes from the Library series, we'll talk to Lynn Hulse Javier, a current Columbia, Maryland resident, but a one-time member of the folk trio, Huos Canto Monemus. We'll talk more about that name in a few minutes. A band whose career was promising, if short-lived. Lynn was one of the vocalists and principal songwriters and guitar players who recorded an album in 1969 in Potomac, Maryland, of mostly original music. Parts Peter, Paul, and Mary with a unique haunting purity. We'll talk with Lynn and listen to portions of two different tracks selected by Lynn and another band member, Glenn Mead. So we'll start today with me telling you how I first heard Lynn and heard their music. And that was through a local label called Federal Green Records here in D.C. They released music, Lost, Obscure, low-run albums, mostly D.C. related. So there's some soul, funk, R&B bands, Cake from Aberdeen, New York, and Coke from D.C., and several others. So Joe Lappin, who is co-owner of the Songbird Cafe down the street from here, had talked about Federal Green Records, and we're going to talk about them a little bit. So through them, I first started listening to this music online. And was sort of taken by the innocent quality of the folk music and reached out to Lynn. So that's my story. Lynn, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So can you tell us how Federal Green got a hold of you?
Yeah. The internet is quite the way to reach people. And James reached out to me actually on Facebook, sent a private message, and I happened to look in that pile of things, and he said, "Are you the Lynn Hulse Javier that was connected with Huos Canto Monemus? And if you are, I'd really love to chat with you, and if not, I'm really sorry, and thanks for your time." And over the years, we've had people reach out to us about the album, which is an amazing thing in itself. So we typed back and forth, and he wanted to know a little bit more about the music. And at one point he said, "Have you ever considered re-releasing the album?" And I'm like, "What? Re-releasing? Are you kidding me?" I thought he was like joking. And so I just sort of let that fly. And a couple months later he contacted me again and said, "So, you know, what do you think?" And I said, "Really?" And so I got a hold of Glenn, who was out in California, living out there, and said, "What? You're not going to believe this, and this person seems to really be interested." And Glenn said, "Well, do we have any outlay of money to do this?" I said, "Nope." He said, "Do we keep the rights to the songs?" I said, "Yep." He said, "This is absolutely crazy. Let's do it." So we met with them and set up a contract, and over time, it took about a year to do the processing. They were very meticulous to create the vinyl again, and came out last December, and it's just been a ride.
Right, and can you fill us in a little bit on the band itself and the recording of the album? How did that come about? I know your father played a significant role in sort of getting the everything right to get the record made and released and stuff. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
My dad was very instrumental in just promoting us. He was incredibly supportive, and we had a obviously we had about 12 songs that we had written and just sort of came up with this, well, why not? And we're able to find someone in Potomac, Wally Knapp, who was a new to the business. He had a day job, but this was a hobby. And we reached out to him and were able to, we recorded it in his living room. He had blankets hanging down between the living room and dining room for muting the sound, and he would be down in the basement, and through our headphones and whatever, we would know it was time to start. And so every single song on the album is a live take. It was not, there was no dubbing, there was no do the music and then the vocals over top. Everything was absolutely live, the way you would have heard us at a show, which made it a huge challenge. Some of the songs we did a lot of times, but that way you really get a product that sounds like we are. There was no monkeying around with it.
And you were all of 16, mm-hmm. and your bandmates, Glenn Mead and Mark Blankner, and they were high school friends.
The two of them were friends, yes, but I met them at a kind of a Methodist-sponsored, we called it a folk festival up in Bethany Beach, and it was an incredibly creative week where you'd get together with, if you'd like to draw, you like to dance, you like to write, you like to do music, and they would have a session where they'd do some parable from the Bible, and you would just sort of talk about it. What did it mean? What might it mean? And then they'd say, go. And you would spend the rest of the day creating whatever it meant to you in any form. And then at night, there were about, I want to say, 40 of us. And at night, we would have like a coffee house, which was so exciting because you'd get to see what and hear what people had created. If you hadn't created anything, it really didn't matter. So Glenn and I just kind of hit it off, and we wrote music together that week. And at the end of the week, it was sort of, we don't want this to end. And he said, how about, you know, the three of us seeing what happens with it? And that's how we got together. They lived up in Baltimore, and I lived in Rockville. So that, I didn't drive, I was 15, so it became a bit of a challenge, but we had a lot of parental support, which was great.
And this was 1968, and you guys were playing in churches and coffee shops around Baltimore. Can you fill us in on what the live scene looked like for the kids?
Yeah, it was an incredible time for live music. There was a huge outreach from the churches to try to get kids more involved. So they had a lot of what they called folk masses or youth services. And Mark's dad was a Methodist minister, which gave us an in to every single church, Methodist church, that was in the Baltimore area. And we would go and play some of our more religious-themed songs. We were not the genre of a Christian group. We were the genre of a storytelling group. And whatever music told a story that worked for our audience, that's what we did. So we would play some of the music that's on the album that's more religious-based, and then the kids would talk to us after the service and say, hey, we've got a coffee house. We would love to have you come. And then, of course, they would pay us. So we really liked that part of it. And I looked in my little scrapbook, and I would write, oh, yeah, we played tonight, and we got paid $30. Mm-hmm. And we thought we were rich.
Right, and we met a little bit before the show today, and you, one of your live stories that stand out, and then we'll talk about the album and play a track here in a couple of minutes. Can you tell me the story about the big lie you were calling the big lie?
Oh.
But I think I found that really fascinating and dangerous.
Yeah.
So a show put on by adults.
Mm-hmm. Back in the spring of 1969, there was an incident at a Doors concert down in Florida with Jim Morrison, who decided to get naked during the show, and he was in a lot of trouble. And of course, the adults who thought rock and roll was a bad thing anyway, that was a good opportunity to say, oh my gosh, you know, and wave their hands in the air. And a lot of cities had what they called decency rallies. In Baltimore, they decided to have one of these also. The problem was those who organized it, adults, made a lot of claims about who would be there that were untrue. We were invited to be part of the pre-show entertainment, and this was, you have to understand, on a Sunday afternoon in the spring, and it was free. So everybody went. Kids who just wanted to hear The Temptations, who were supposed to play, the kids who maybe wanted to hear Bob Hope talk, that was all sorts of performers. They were there, including troublemakers were there too. There were several groups that really just were out to cause some trouble. We performed out on the second base. I mean, it was, I wrote in my notes, it was like being the Beatles at Shea Stadium. It was so amazing to have all these microphones, and it was probably about half full, which would have been somewhere between 15 and 20,000 people.
And you're consulting your notes for those figures, right?
Because I did. I looked at my scrapbook this morning and went, wow, yeah, I did write that. And so when we were finished, we were escorted as performers up to a guarded mezzanine section because, of course, we wanted to see the Temptations and Bob Hope and the Cowsills and everybody else that they said would be there. And as the show actually started and somebody came out and blah, blah, blah about being decent and blah, 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 rock and roll is bad, we're looking down from the mezzanine and going, I think there's a fight over there. Uh-oh, what's going on over there? And we realized that something was not going to go the way we wanted it to. And we said, I think it's time to get out of here. So we went back to our guarded elevator and went down to the dressing rooms, which was very cool, being down there where the baseball players had been, and took our guitars and started to leave. And at that point, there were a lot of very angry-looking people by the gates as we were leaving Memorial Stadium, the grounds itself. And their comment was, oh, they're performers. Let them go. And I had brought the newspaper this morning, and there were over 100 people arrested, over 100 people hurt. And it really, because I think the kids felt deceived. It wasn't necessarily the message, but you can't do that to people. But it was...
You mean you can't teach morals through lying? That seems shocking to me.
Not going there with that.
Anyway, but a shocking headline for something that was supposed to be a lot of fun.
Yes.
But thanks for that. I was going to read the jacket of the album, which I'm holding here. These are the liner notes from a friend of yours, is that right?
Phil, is that the one you're reading?
This one here. Was Cantu Monemus?
That was from Patches. They had the very well-known in Baltimore Patches and Liz 15 Below coffee house that he had a television show, and we were on that, and we got four encores, and so he asked us to play at his club, and we kind of became regulars there. And yes, he wrote some of the liner notes on there.
So right, I'm gonna read this, and then we can play the first track called Railroad Song, and you can provide some comments on that song. But this is Patch's liner notes here about the group. So three talented young people, namely Lynn Hulse with a lusty and lovely contra alto voice, Mark Blankner and Glenn Mead, each soloist in their own right. The vocal blend and interpretation of their material is a joy to hear. Not only is all of their material on this album original, but their arrangements are beautifully tasteful. So that's just a portion of that. So why don't you tell us about Railroad Song, and then we'll play a portion of that.
Okay. Railroad Song was one I had written. And at some point, I did a lot of singing, just, you know, goofing around. And the song I've been working on, The Railroad, I don't know, singing at a campfire or something. And I started thinking about it. It was like, wow, that's a pretty happy song for something that probably wasn't so happy. And I just started playing around with that in my head. and started, so the Railroad song is sort of my version of what I've been working on the railroad probably really was. And then we would get together when one of us had written music, and we would just work the song and work the song and work the song to arrange it, which was so much fun. We'd spend hours just getting it to a place where we all were contributing and all happy with it, and that was a song we did do in concert. So yeah, that's the Railroad song.
Keep the line of moving, lay them rails. There ain't no time for your body in a well ahead, even though it breaks your back. Get a moving and lay those tracks. Got more miles to run today. My ma died giving me.
That was the Railroad song, and we're going to hear a track a little bit later in the show, Trees They Do Grow High, selected by another band member. So I thought we took a little bit more about you guys playing out, and you played locally, but I know there was some more high-profile venues where you played. Can you talk a little bit more about those, Lynn?
Yeah, we had an opportunity to go up to New York City, and we played at the Bitter End and the Gaslight. We were, it was kind of open mic-ish idea. It was an opportunity for some record people up there to hear us. And it was just so exciting because, again, here we were just, you know, three kids, and off we are in places where Peter, Paul, and Mary and Bob Dylan got started. So we played probably as far south as Richmond, but it was very much of an exciting thing to be able to just play at all these different venues.
And so delving back into the making of the album a little bit more, so it was recorded in Potomac, Maryland at that gentleman's home. And the album is released. And so what does that look like when the album's out there?
Well, we had made the album. We never had it in stores or anything because the promotion and all of that, it was just way out of our budget. We didn't have a budget. So we would take that with us when we would perform, and people would buy it there. And over the years, it's been an amazing thing when people have reached out to us again to want copies of the album. And it actually, before the re-release, had been sold on eBay for over $1,000, which is just mind-boggling.
And the time of its release, it was going for about $3, right?
I think between $3 and $5, yeah.
And can I give you a hard time about the band name? I figure if you name a band in Latin, you're asking people to ask, one, how do you pronounce it, and two, what does it mean? So can you pronounce it again? Because I feel like I probably didn't hit it right. And then can you tell us what the translation is of the Latin?
Yes, it's Vos Cantum Onemus, and the Latin translation is basically, we warn you with song. And Glenn went to Polytechnic High School in Baltimore. He had a friend in a Latin class who actually came up with that. When we decided to be a trio, it was really difficult to not come up with something that sounded like Peter, Paul, and Mary. And having two guys and a girl and doing the folk music, it was kind of a struggle to, like, what are we going to call ourselves? And when we came up with this, or Glenn brought this name to us, we just said, wow, yeah, no one will ever mistake us for Peter, Paul, and Mary. But it made us very unique. Even if they couldn't pronounce it, they knew if they heard something that was unpronounceable, it must be us. So we didn't get lost in just having names out there.
Good. I like that. Okay, I'm a little sold on that now. I'm warming to it, let's say. I'll continue to mispronounce it, but I'm warming to the idea. And so we talked a while ago, and I asked you when the album was made and why it was made. I presumed it was some vanity project, or a vanity, not vanity in a negative way, just more sort of a document of your songs, but you made it seem like it was a lot more serious than that. Can you talk about, like, your intentions of, you're essentially kids, and your dad was a supporter, obviously, and the band members' families were supporters. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the level of seriousness, I guess you could say, at that time? Is what I think you were mostly, you know, teenagers, so.
Yeah, we were. And it was one of those, we were young and we didn't know we couldn't, so we did. And we came one evening down here to Constitution Hall and saw Peter, Paul, and Mary, and had the opportunity to meet and chat with them after the show. And, you know, obviously we told them that we were musicians, and they were incredibly supportive and, you know, just sort of said, keep at it, keep at it. And we were getting very good responses from where we played, and it was sort of, you know, what is the next level? What can we do with this? I kind of chose my college based on its proximity to Baltimore so that we could continue to practice. I mean, that wasn't the only reason, but its location was a good thing, that I wouldn't have gone out of state because we were playing music, and I loved it. We all had such a good time together.
And I'm holding the record here in front of me. And so you guys handmade the title lettering and stuff. Can you talk me through that? It's a black cover, and there's a picture of the three of you. You look very posed, actually, with guitars strung over Mark and Glenn's backs there. But can you talk about the physicality of putting together this item?
Yeah, we wanted to obviously do it in color because everybody else had, you know, it was the 60s and, you know, bright colors. Well, that was too expensive, and so Glenn drew the letters, and we hand cut them out on white paper, and we kind of laid it all out, and all of the photographs were taken in my backyard. Again, my dad was very helpful, and we ran around the backyard and in different outfits, and we jumped off of things, and we climbed up things, and spent the day just amusing ourselves, and then we took all the pictures and went, okay, we like this, we like that, and we arranged it, and that's how we did it. And I chuckle when people have contacted us and said, oh, your album, your cover's so retro, and how did you do this? And it was like, we did what we did because that really was our only option, and we had no idea it would look trendy 49 years later.
Yeah, it's aged well, actually. Yeah, it just looks like a vintage, sort of a newer album that's sort of recalling an earlier time, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then can you tell us how you were received by your peers at that time? I mean, you were kids, as I keep saying, but was there other musicians in the scene, and how did they respond to you at that time?
Really positively. We were in the Baltimore area a lot. We really kind of got into that circuit because of our... the guys had just a lot more contacts up there, and very well received. There were very few groups where there was a trio where all three people could sing. Sometimes you'd have a single person playing guitar, sometimes a duo, but then one person would have a good voice. But with us, we all could sing. I really didn't play guitar that great, but I could certainly strum along, whereas Glenn and Mark's arrangements on the guitar were just incredible. So we were kind of had a lot of skills that not everybody else had, and we were extremely well received. It was a blast. And we were not only at coffee houses, again, looking through my scrapbook of stuff, we played like at Walter Reed Hospital. We also played, I know we played down at Quantico for the soldiers. So we, wherever we had an opportunity to bring our music, we did.
Yeah. And I just wanted to reiterate, the record itself is available at Joint Custody around U Street. And you can download songs and listen to those at federalgreenrecords.bandcamp.com or federalgreenrecords.com. And so why don't we move into another track here? This is Trees, They Do Grow High. But first, let's hear Glenn's comments about that song. And Lynn, can you provide those for us, please?
That was the one song we did not write. But Glenn's favorite, and he chose this one. Everything was original lyrics and music, except for Berwick Town, and actually there was another one. And The Trees They Do Grow High actually had music and lyrics to it. But as you'll hear, Glenn and Mark's guitar stuff is just incredibly beautiful. And so Mark and I did it as a duet, a kind of a conversation, again, telling a story. And that's what we did best.
So that was mountains, trees. They do grow high. Beautiful, beautiful recording there. A little choked up here on my side of things.
Thank you.
So, yeah, I hear something delicate and sensitive, and sure, the Peter, Paul, Mary thing fits just because of the two guys and a girl thing. But, yeah, there's a sort of a care given to that arrangement and playing. And so that's what I hear in all of this album and in some of the softer, quieter tracks. But what do you hear when we were just listening to that now?
Oh, gosh, it's like I could close my eyes and see singing on stage with Mark. That was a song that we did. I loved singing that with him. He was such an excellent performer on stage. He loved the audience, and they loved him right back. And he was our, I don't want to call him silly one, but he would do some of the silly songs like Arlo Guthrie's The Motorcycle Song or Talking Candy Bar Blues, because he could. And those were not originals, but they were so his personality. And so it just takes me back to just a really intense, wonderful time in my life.
And we're moving towards the end of today's episode, and I wanted to have you tell us about the end of the band. I know. We were moving towards that. We were talking earlier, maybe 3 solid years together.
Yeah.
And then there's some logistical reasons for the breakup, it sounds like.
Yeah. When I went to college, none of us had cars. Glenn was at Hopkins, and Mark was at a community college. I was at what was then Western Maryland. And so rehearsals became really problematic, and we were really at a point where we had actually talked with an agent, a real live agent, and it was a little scary that pretty much we'd almost like have to stop going to school. That he said, you know, if I get you a job and it's in this place, then that's where we're going to go. And both Glenn and I, were focused on going to school. He particularly was pre-med, and that was very important. So we kind of pulled back from that, and I can speak for myself that I really got a little, perhaps too involved with the social life at college, and it just became a place where we were going to have to stop where we were, and I missed very much performing with them, and so we went kind of different ways at that point.
And Mark Blankner is no longer around. Can you tell us a little bit about what became of Mark, and then we can talk more about Glenn and your role in your lives now?
Yeah. Mark was just a free spirit, a wonderful guy, and very... very sadly, in the spring of 1977, he was murdered in Baltimore at a drug deal gone bad. I really don't know many more details than that because Glenn had called me to tell me, and such a loss.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry for that. And you and Glenn are still in touch. Can you tell us a little bit about what Glenn is up to these days?
Yeah, we've been sporadically in touch, and really this re-release of the album may actually, we have not seen each other since 1971, but we've talked on the phone and stuff, and he has done a tremendous amount of writing. He did go on to become a doctor, but he worked overnight so that he could write music, do his love of music during the day, and he's written what he calls serious music, and that includes symphonies, musicals, operas, string quartets. I know he wrote a choral piece for 8-part harmony. I mean, what a genius
he
is.
And he's out in California.
He is in California now, and he would perform have performances, he told me, in his attic that would seat 30 people. And he would create a lot. He did a lot of the electronic music creating, which was so good, and some of his stuff, he has several CDs available through his company, which is Synthestra.com, And I know the most recent one that I had seen was he did a big band album, because he and his wife at the time did a lot of the Dancing with the Stars kind of competition. And so he wrote some music, and so talented.
And what's his response to this reappreciation of the music?
Oh, my gosh. Sort of like mine. He said, I can't believe this album is being sought after. Many other groups at that time were better, but it's fun to see. And he said, I don't understand why we're referred to as hippie or psych folk, as our music on the album was frequently religion-based, probably just because the album came out in the late 60s.
Just a product of its time.
Yep.
It's not that, but it's ushered in with all that other stuff.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
And then music remains vital to your life
now. Yes, yes.
And what do you do?
Over the years, I had a chance to sing in a blues band, and then I also had a chance to be in a cover rock and roll band with my husband, who's a terrific keyboard player. And I also, because I played guitar, had an opportunity to just sing at so many of my friends' weddings over the years, which was just so nice and so personal and special. And in the past 5 years, 5.5 years, I've been a Sweet Adeline, which is we compete and we sing a cappella, four-part harmony, and have competed locally and internationally, which is so much fun, and I love the chance to sing.
And I wanted to add that through a recording like this, you know, you lost a friend in Mark, and you know, he's still around through the music, so that's sort of an obvious thing to say and maybe a sentimental thing to say, but it's still true.
Oh, very true.
And so
true.
He's
very
present
true.
On the recording.
Absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely. Both Glenn and I have said, Mark, if he was alive, he'd not only be out dancing in the street, but he'd say, let's do a reunion tour. Yeah. Let's take our show on the road, because that was him, and we both are think of him very much in this whole process, and we're all very grateful to joint custody / Federal Green Records for having interest and believing in our music. It's something we never ever would have expected, anticipated, but it's been amazing.
Yeah, so it's 12 tracks. My favorite track wasn't played.
Sorry.
So it's called I've Cried Once. And it's Federal Green Records at Bandcamp or .bandcamp.com, and federalgreenrecords.com is the website. Or you can walk into the store at Joint Custody and ask for
Words Never Said by Vos Contumonemus.
Well, thank you, Lynn, for coming out to DC and visiting with us and sharing your music.
Thank you. This has been a wonderful opportunity for me. Thank you.
You're welcome. So this has been an episode of DC Public Library's Notes from the Library on Full Service Radio. To learn more about the DC Public Library, please visit us at dclibrary.org or follow us on Twitter / Instagram at DCPL. Upcoming special collections programs include Saving Family Treasures, a personal archiving workshop 101 at Woodridge Library, June 16th. It's a Saturday from 1 to 3. 1968 pop-up museum event April 7th from 12 to 4 at Anacostia Library. We have a DC 1968 project website for everyone to visit. That's www.dc1968project.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at DC 1968 project, hashtag in quotes DC 1968. So thank you for listening, and have a good afternoon.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts, covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.